Major Cochrane, Reel 6. Now, we're talking about your time at Sandhurst, officer cadet training. What about, you're talking about tactical exercise. What about, you mentioned earlier also night exercises. What sort of things would you do in a night exercise?
Well, really, very much the, on a much reduced scale, sort of things we did in daylight. I think, looking back, probably one of the options is to try to teach you to control yourself, or if it was your turn to be in charge of a section, control other people and communicate with other people in the dark. And because of the blackout, in London suburbs weren't blazing away in the sky, so it really was dark. Underfoot, during the course of that winter, certainly in December and in January, there was deep snow, which I suppose added verisimilitude in a way, made some night manoeuvring much more difficult, and some of it much easier, because of course, however dark the sky, there's enough light to reflect from snow, so things are much more visible at night. And I think really, thinking about it now, the idea was to get into your head that things could be a bloody muddle at night, and it was your job to reduce the muddle so far as lay in your power, either for your own behaviour or other people's.
Any other aspects of tactical exercise or exercises you recall?
No more, I think, than we'd already been doing in daylight. There were no special night things that I can remember.
What about other aspects of being an officer? Were you taught any aspect of military law and sort of your...
Yes, you were. You were told that probably, whenever you were, or if you were commissioned, you were never told that you would be, that if you were commissioned, probably at some point you would be told to attend a court-martial or a court of inquiry as an observer. I mean, you'd merely be sitting at the back listening. And the proceedings would go as follows. And then there was a description of the Army's legal department, the judge, advocate, general, and this is that, and how a court-martial worked, the role of the defence, the prisoner's friend, and the role of the prosecuting officer. And the fact that this was, if you like, I suppose the analogy was the magistrate's court. There'd be a court of inquiry, which in fact established that there were grounds for a full-blown court-martial. Then you came down another notch to the much commoner, of course, if you like, comparatively minor infringements of discipline, which were dealt with at one level by the commanding officer of the battalion, and at a lesser level by the company commander. And the, I've forgotten them now, but it was, there was a strict, rather like caning at school, there was a strict limit on the sort of punishment that a company commander could administer. And if he thought the offence was too serious for one of his level punishments, that always went to the CO. And certain offences, again I've forgotten what they were, went automatically to the CO. There was no sort of preliminary with the company commander. And this was explained to one. I don't think we had law as such, beyond an impression that it was sort of civil law with knobs on, more or less.
Now, what about how to, things like man management and how to behave as an officer in front of the men? We actually taught that, or was that expected?
Partly expected, but it was rubbed in. I mean, for instance, you were told that, again, this was a very good thing after night exercises, particularly in the snow, where the pretense that you were in command of another seven people broke down when you got back into barracks. But the point was made that on an occasion like this, oh, I suppose it's just training and you're training with your platoon, when you get back, number one is weapon cleaning, weapons cleaned, oiled. Then number two was the men you were in charge of, whatever was could be done, or I mean, was dry kit available if you'd been absolutely soaked or crossing the river. At the very least, rather had they another pair of boots to get into. And it was rubbed in, but only after these two things had been done was the officer entitled to think of his own comfort. And I think it was expected that we'd know this without being told, but we were told just in case, in no uncertain terms.
What about standards of behaviour required in the mess and in the way you just behave, just behaviour?
Well, I think they tried to tell us not to be frightened, that in fact the chap, the major who was bawling you out on the barrack square, when he talked to you perfectly affably in the mess at lunchtime or in the evening, he was neither apologising for his behaviour before, trying to instill a feel-good factor into you. He was behaving as he should behave, and the way you should behave was a fact to remember that you were, you know, you were going to be, if you were commissioned, a second lieutenant, which is the lowliest form of life, and you know, much less important to the major, if you like, than the corporals and the sergeants under his command. So don't get swelled heads and don't get any fancy ideas. And I think, again, you were told that, obviously, on parade, your senior officers were sir, and in the mess, until you were given a sort of signal, more or less, or you bother with that, certainly you could call fellow lieutenants and even captains by their name, surname. But you still went on calling a major, and certainly a lieutenant colonel, sir, in the mess, until or unless he said, oh, you know, we're in the mess, skip that. Christian names, we weren't used very much. Perhaps that's a sort of hangover from being at boarding school, where one got very accustomed to everybody was known by their surname, which I suppose made life simpler. And I think, I mean, if one'd been at university, this habit had started to break down. And for instance, the people I knew, the cadets I mucked around with at Sandhurst, we used to call each other by a Christian name, not our surname. And this held good. I mean, when I eventually got to our depot, all the subalterns called each other by their Christian names, I think. But you were warned to be pretty careful about not suddenly calling your company commander Willie or Charlie until he indicated to you that he was prepared to accept that.
And what about, we warned against drink, I mean, it's fairly obvious, but we warned against drinking too much and about the importance of settling your mess bill, things like that, or was it just...
Well, they're told that you're going to be on a very small amount of your pay. I forgot what it was, actually, now, the second offence pay then. Equally, it was told that it's assumed that none of you have got access to great private means, private wealth. Therefore, your mess bill is something you'll have to watch for two reasons. One, that it's a very serious, looked on as a very serious, ungentlemanly thing to give the mess secretary a bad check. So you've got to watch that. And secondly, the mess secretary is usually a captain, at least. You were told that if the mess secretary saw that Second Lieutenant X was running up too excitable or exciting a mess bill, he should be given something should be said to him. And this was usually left. I can never remember it happening to me, but I think it was the chap's company commander was told that so-and-so seems to be living it up a bit. And I can't remember any other. I do remember being told, but as a slight joke, that in peacetime, you know, the new subaltern in duty band, when he got to his battalion, had to leave cards on the married officers' wives and how you left cards. But, I mean, this was told you was a relic of not very distant past, but just of the past. Nobody suggested that we were going to go around dropping cards on Mrs. Major so-and-so.
Now, anything else? So you mentioned guard duty. You had to do guard duties.
Yes.
What were you guarding? Just
The premises, really. We did mount guard properly, just the same way that it had been done in a unit. And I suppose there must have been, the guard consisted of 10 or 15 cadets. We patrolled the grounds. I think they obviously had the proper regular soldiers who were on guard duty at the entrances. But the grounds were very big, and anybody, I think, could have climbed over fences here and there. It wasn't sort of done like a concentration camp. And one rule, really, was to make sure there were no interlopers. And anybody who was moving around after 10 p.m. or something, you stopped them. You had to stop them to find out who they were. We were told, because the staff college was in the same grounds at Camberley, and these, therefore, were high and mighty officers in our eyes. And you'd be very careful if you were saying halt to somebody to couch it in fairly sensible terms. No obscenities to follow, you know, halt you so-and-so and so-and-so, in case it turned out we're major going back to the staff college mess.
Anything else about your time at Sandhurst?
No, except I think that most of us by definition were older than the pre-war cadets had been, because most of us had either started university or in many cases had done university and had been in fact in jobs. So and they tried to cater for this, I mean, adjust the training to the fact that we didn't need a lot of what people who were going to Sandhurst from school needed. But even so, I think we felt beyond a certain point that we weren't going to get any more benefit out of this. For heaven's sake, let's get going and let's go to our...
How were you assessed at the end of the course?
I have no idea. We all had a report written on us. Unlike reports nowadays in the army, I mean, every officer has an annual report and he has to initial it, I mean, to show that he's ready. And I can't remember ever reading any, of course, when on active service, but none of that. There wasn't time. And we obviously didn't have a report made on us at Sandhurst. And I suppose that coloured. There may have been some cadets who weren't commissioned, but I can't remember any. This happened, of course, everybody hoped to get into a certain regiment.
Now, how did you pick yours, or was it just obvious?
Well, I had a complication after that. I applied to join the Cameron Highlanders on the grounds. This is the regiment my father had joined first in the beginning of World War I. And I, one vestige of the old days was it was still desirable to ask to have an interview with the colonel of the regiment if you wanted to join a particular regiment. And the colonel was not, of course, a commanding officer. The colonel of an infantry regiment, and I suppose every other sort of regiment, was in fact an old member of that regiment and a retired senior officer, I mean at least a major general, probably a general. And in peacetime, the idea had been that the colonel of the regiment kept a sort of fatherly eye on both battalions and on the depot, and if questions which weren't strictly about military discipline but seemed to affect the regiment as an entity came up, he was a kind of arbiter who wasn't involved in the day-to-day running of the thing. You might say a chairman with different chief executives under him. And one of the things the colonel of the regiment did was to interview applicants from Sandhurst, or they introduced a system of taking people who were actually at university, and during the university course you got accepted, or even some. No, I don't think in those days you were accepted for the army before they were starting the university. It happened after the war, I know, because then chaps were sent by the army to the university. In this case, I went to see the colonel of the Camden Highlanders.
Do you remember who it was?
He was a super chap, General Neville Cameron, who had commanded one of the battalions with great distinction in World War I. And he lived, oddly enough, in Bedford. A lot of army officers went to Bedford. Pre-war army officers tend to marry a bit later than you'd expect, because in many regiments, not until you were a captain were you thought fit to be able to look after a wife or to afford a wife. And therefore, they still had the education of their children to bother about. When, in this case, even when people had retired, Bedford in those days was renowned for the fact it had absolutely first-class day schools, rather in the same way Edinburgh has. He's living in Bedford, and I went to see General Neville, who was very agreeable and polite, asked me a search of questions about my father, about why I wanted to join the Camerons, and how was I learning much or anything at Sandhurst, how was it going? And I got the okay from him. And then when the notice went up about what regiments everybody had been posted commissioned in, I found I'd been commissioned into the Highland Light Infantry, which was a very famous regiment, but certainly not a regiment I wanted to get into. And I got an awful stew about this, didn't know what to do, who to talk to. Thought I can't ring up General Neville Cameron. He may have even forgotten who the hell I am by now. But luckily at the Staff College, there was a tall, distinguished major whom we used to see walking to and fro, wearing a black watch coat and a monocle. And this was Bernard Ferguson, who later became so well known. And I suddenly thought of him, and I went over to the Staff College itself, knocked on the door, asked if I could see Major Ferguson, who didn't know, never talked to me before. But I explained the position and said, I think there's been some sort of muddle, at least I hope it's a muddle, and I don't know how to sort it out. And that's why I've come to see you, sir. Is there anything, you know? He said, well, I don't know, I'll see. But he did see and got it sorted out. So that was rescinded, and I was duly commissioned into the Queen's Own Cameron Highlanders, to my great relief. And it turned out to be a very fortunate thing, too. And I never ceased to be grateful to it. And I reminded him several times, because we met on odd occasions after the war.
Now, what about kitting out? What did you do that while you were...
Yes, after you've been told what regiment you're going to be commissioned into, you were also told the names of regimental tailors if special kit was required, and certainly in a Scottish regiment special kit was required. And I went to one of these. No, I think they sent down sort of chaps to Sandhurst, and they'd measure up, you know, half a dozen pieces. And I think the people I went to also made uniforms for a number of regiments, mostly Highland ones. Though oddly enough, their base was in London, not in Edinburgh.
Now, what was the officer's kit for your regiment?
You had one, what was called an SD jacket, service dress jacket. That was the khaki jacket made of cloth with regimental badges on the collar and so on. A kilt, probably two pairs of trews.
Tartan trews.
Yes. And khaki shirts, khaki tie. For your kilt, you have to have khaki stockings. And I think things like boots and battle dress, that was supplied to you when you got to your unit.
By the army?
Yes, by the army.
What about?
I think you did have, as I recollect, some sort of uniform allowance, which didn't go far enough, and my father had to pay something towards all this.
What about things like valise, washstand, things like that? Or was that?
Yes, you were told that you would have to get that, but you were also told there was no need to get it now because you're. Everybody was going to be posted to their regimental depot. But when you were posted to a battalion, you would need to get these things. But it was then said, and your regiment will tell you what you need to get in the way of camp kit. What else did I? Well, of course, the Highland Regiment, as well as kilt stockings, black brogue shoes. You need to have a little black-handled knife, a ski and do, to stick in your stocking. Sam Brown belt, of course. You were issued, I mean, obviously, no weapons until you reached the other end. Balmoral and a Glengarry. Two sorts of headgear. What else? You never had a Well, I think in English it was called a swagger stick, you know, a short leather covered thing like that. We never had those. You had to have a cherry wood walking stick if you were a junior officer. And I can't think of really anything else.
Now, what was the date of your commission, or when did you leave Sandhurst, either way?
I think it was March.
1940. So, where were you posted to then?
Straight to the Cameron Barracks in Inverness.
Now, did that have a name other than, or was it known as the Cameron?
Cameron Barracks still is. It's a large, like a huge toy fort. Rather handsome, actually, in its Victorian military way.
And. What was your reception at the depot? How did they sort of take you in?
Chaotic, because it was, you had to report to the orderly or to the adjutant. He was the first person you saw. Probably in that given a week, shall we say, one or two newly commissioned subalterns had arrived. But the barracks, I suppose like every barracks at that time, was absolutely jammed because there were all the retired officers who were still on the reserve list, if you like, had come back, and they were in the barracks, in the mess. There were the existing recruits finishing their recruit training before going off to the battalions, with new recruits coming in all the time. And when I say recruits, some of them, quite a lot of them were volunteers, but equally the process of conscription was now underway. So there was a quite a biggish intake. The result was that there were far too many officers and soldiers for the barracks to accommodate, and there was no distillery down in the town. That was taken over, and a whole company was in there, officers and men.
Were you there, or were
you? No, I was billeted in the house was owned by the excise man at another distillery. There were three of us billeted on this chap and his wife, and they were very kind to us. You only had to give us a loud cough getting back at night, going to bed after a very hard day's work in the barracks. I've got them there now, but Mrs. would arrive, tap on the door, and say, "Oh, I heard you coughing when you come in. Here's a wee toddy just to." And the wee toddy, really, you had to be lying in bed before you could drink it, it was so strong. Very acceptable. Again, this was getting towards the spring, so it wasn't anything like as cold as it had been at Sandhurst. But it was all a bit chaotic, and it was like, I don't know, departure lives of an airport.
Now, what were you said after a busy day, what were you doing?
Well, half the time one didn't know. A lot of the time, well, we decided that the useful thing, very helpful for us, to be put in charge of drill training to see if we'd learnt anything at Sandhurst, so how not only to do drill ourselves but to command other people at drill. And then we were used as instructors with somebody keeping an eye on us over things like the Bren gun for the new intake.
So you're acting as NCOs almost?
That's right, yes.
And how did you do at that? What did you think of it?
I think I must have done all right, because I had a huge stroke of luck. At that time, the regiment had one of the first battalion. Like any regiment, it had two regular battalions and one or more territorial battalions, and then the hub of the whole thing was the regimental depot. And we had, the 1st Battalion was with the BEF in France, and the 2nd Battalion had been serving in India and had just been sent to the Middle East as part of an Indian division.
Was that the 4th?
That was the 2nd.
2nd, right.
And the what was called the 4th Battalion was a territorial battalion. It was the 4th and the 5th, two territorial battalions. They were training like mad, because most of the territorials had only joined up just before the war in 1939. And they eventually, again, they went to France. I should think it was not a very well-trained state, but I don't know. In 1940. So we did have, with the 51st Highland Division, and then they, of course, caught in the surrender of St. Valery. So most of them, apart from quite a number who escaped, most of them spent the war in German POW camps.